Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. Words matter in our relationships, in our politics, in our culture. The words we use and the way we use them shape how we relate to the world and how the world perceives us. It is lucky, then, that the English language is so colorful, so filled with entertaining, sometimes provocative, sometimes beautiful, even sometimes inspiring turns of phrase. It's also filled with vulgarity and cliché. A language so rich deserves study and analysis, and it's also, frankly, kind of fun to talk about the words that we use, where they come from, how they're used or misused, and ultimately, why we say the things we say the way we say them. Today on Focus, a conversation about words and word usage with linguist Jeff Nunberg. You hear his commentaries about language from time to time on Fresh Air. He's a professor at the UC Berkeley School of Information and emeritus chair of the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary and the author of several books about language, including his latest, Ascent of the A Word. Jeff Nunberg, welcome to Focus.
Well, thank you for having me.
Glad to have you with us, and we welcome your questions and comments about words, word origins, common or uncommon phrases in the English language, maybe some pet peeves you have. Anything you'd like to discuss about the words we use and how and why we use them is welcome this morning. To talk with linguist Jeff Nunberg, call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. As always, I also point out we welcome your questions on our Facebook page. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. Jeff, I thought in the context of the current election season and recent debates, maybe we could start by talking a little bit about the language of politics. One subject I know you explored not too long ago for Fresh Air was the history and use of the word entitlement and how it has changed. How has it changed?
It's a fascinating word because it's the result of a sort of a train wreck between two very distinct senses of the word. It has this legal sense or political sense where it refers to programs, basically programs that are extra budget, programs that that don't fall under the budget, but that give benefits to anybody who qualifies for them. And that might be Social Security. It might also be farm price supports. On the other hand, it comes into the language about the same time, around 1970, in the psychological literature, in the turn towards psychology, as one of the terms that people use to define narcissism, sense of entitlement. So these two terms are moving along, and then they kind of converge to the point where all of a sudden, when people talk about a culture of entitlement, they suggest not just that entitlements have become too expensive in the political sense, but that somehow they are, as Mitt Romney said, people who feel they have a right to things, I mean, perhaps an unwarranted right. So it's as if the psychological meaning of the word has infused the political sense and turned it into a kind of narcissism.
We have an email from Sean who would like to know about the use of the phrase "my friend" during debates.
Yeah, it's interesting. I meant to track it down and see how long. People have been using "my friend" for a long time. It's one of those words like "folks" that appear almost exclusively in political context and use car advertisements. I don't walk into a class and say, "Well, folks," but it's a kind of staged or formal informality, if you will.
We have another email from Vincent who would like to hear your thoughts about how the word liberal has changed. He says, in the old days it meant one thing, as in generous. Nowadays, he says, it's quite a pejorative.
Yeah, well, it acquires its political sense, what we think of its political sense, around the time of the New Deal, maybe 1935, 1936. And it means that for a long time. It's a not only a respectable word, but the dominant word in American political discourse in the 50s and 60s. People speak of liberal Republicans, and people proudly proclaim themselves liberal Republicans. It begins to become tainted in the 70s and then the 80s, the L word, as Reagan called it. And it now calls up for a lot of people all of these invidious stereotypes of latte-sipping, Volvo-driving, New York Times reading, body-piercing. I'm quoting from the subtitle of my last book, which I can never remember, but... But all of those invidious stereotypes of the liberal academics, the liberal Upper West Side, Hollywood, it basically is a social stereotype rather than a political stereotype. Some of that begins from the left, actually, because it was the left also that took after liberals as insincere bourgeois, insufficiently committed. And we've reached the point where liberals still hanging on in American political discourse, but a lot of people of that stripe have begun to call themselves progressives. And I hear now on the right, I hear newscasters or radio broadcasters saying, speaking of so-called progressives, which is an indication, so-called is the word you use when you don't control the conversation anymore. And it may be an indication that that word's having a certain success.
Well, so-called also maybe has a similar connotation within journalism circles as alleged, that if you feel like you can't out and out say something is, you know, whatever it is you want to categorize it as, you might use that term.
Yeah, no, that's right. But I think when it's used by the right, this so-called progressives, it's as if to say, I know they call themselves progressives. I don't like it, but I can't take the term away from them.
Oh, I see.
So it is, in a certain sense, a confession of linguistic weakness when it's used. In the same way that people on the left will speak of so-called family values.
Well, by way
of admitting that the right owns that expression.
I was going to ask also why it is that the term liberal, as the email suggested, includes these particularly, I guess, supposedly pejorative concepts, at least for those on the right. Why that's not the case for those on the left with the word conservative?
Well, there was a time when conservative had those connotations in the 50s and 60s. I think that the right has been very successful, with the help of certain elements of the left historically, in branding liberals as a lifestyle choice, liberalism as a lifestyle choice rather than political ideology. And the left has simply not been able to do that with conservative, to the point where lots more people identify themselves as conservative than liberal now. Though if you actually ask them their positions, you find that they fall a little bit to the left of center.
When it comes to politics, election seasons, the debates, do you find yourself as a linguist watching, paying attention, and sort of fixating on specific words, phrases, language that is used on the campaign trail?
Sure. This year has been interesting, in fact, because of the language that you're not hearing. We just mentioned family values. I haven't heard family values or values. You heard it a bit during the Republican primary campaign. But you haven't heard it at all from the party nominees this time, probably because it's traditionally a word of the right, and because Romney, who should actually be in a strong position to use it, because of his history on social issues, is staying away from those issues, and because he's stressing the economy. So that's an example of a term we used to hear. We heard a lot of certainly in the last election, particularly from Sarah Palin. We're not hearing much of at all. Patriotism. A word that figured a lot during the Bush years. You hear less, probably because the support the war business is no longer a major theme in American political discourse. So it's as interesting for the things you're not hearing as for the things you are.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is linguist Jeff Nunberg. He's a frequent contributor to Fresh Air and the New York Times, among other publications. He teaches at the UC Berkeley School of Information and is emeritus chair of the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary and the author of several books about language, including his latest, Ascent of the A-Word. We're talking about words and word origins, and we welcome your questions and comments about common or uncommon words or phrases in the English language, maybe some pet peeves, maybe some grammar pet peeves. We can, you know, veer in that direction a little too. Clichés. Basically, anything you'd like to address about the words we use and how we use them is welcome this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or you can email your question or comment to will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's set politics and political language aside and just talk in more general terms about words and phrases that we have a tendency to use or misuse that find their way into everyday conversation. The first one that occurs to me, and it's one of those little pet peeves of mine, the misuse or misunderstanding of the definition of the word literally.
Oh, yeah. That's you know, it's funny. If I have a pet peeve, it's almost the phrase pet peeve.
Fair enough.
If you have a pet peeve. It's like having a pet theory, I think. It should be something that only you have. You know, I have a pet theory that...
Oh, I see.
That jazz was invented in Seattle or something like that. But people's pet peeves tend to be things they share with a lot of people. That said, literally, and maybe that said is another one, I hear that. That said, literally, is probably one of the two or three items that most often come up when the topic of pet peeves arises. People can't stand the idea. And they say he was literally climbing the wall. How can you possibly say that? And so on. I think it's interesting. I'll tell you why. But first of all, people have been using literally this way at least since the Thackeray said, I was literally blazing with wit, and you find it in Dickens and so on and so forth. People have been using the word that way since the middle of the 19th century at least. And so there's nothing new about this. It's not a sudden development. It's been going on for a long time. I think we all use the word that way until somebody points out to us, well, you know, literally means literally, the letter. And we say, oh, yeah, I see. And so, and then we start correcting ourselves and everybody else. If the objection to literally is correct, and you can argue one way or the other, it has the interesting property of being the only word in the English language that you cannot use figuratively.
Point taken. Wow. Okay, here's another one. When did stupider and stupidest become acceptable words in the English language? It seems
to
me
the comparative and superlative.
As opposed to more stupid and most stupid. There was a time I didn't remember hearing it in common conversation until, it seems to me, about 20 years ago. But maybe that's just my own ears catching up with the times.
Well, I have to say I kind of like stupider because it sounds stupider. And you are talking, stupid's a very interesting word. I was writing about it at one point and didn't publish that. But it's a fascinating word and a fascinating notion. It's the only charge you can make that will disturb a kid in the schoolyard that isn't a vulgar word, right? It's the worst thing you can say without going to vulgarity to somebody, and I think to say stupider is in a certain sense to play on that notion. So I think it's kind of a joke. There are jokes that come into language that way. Snuck, for example, people still get a shirty about snuck, and you know it should be sneaked and so on. It turns out now actually that snuck is the dominant form, at least in American English, but it began as a joke, maybe because it sounded sneakier. It began in the 19th century as a kind of joke word, and there are these joke words that work their way into the language and become part of ordinary English. And my sense is that stupider is one of those, and that we'll have it as ordinary English in a relatively short period of time.
As I mentioned, you're emeritus chair of the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary, and it occurs to me that part of the discussion we're having here is a question of when does it become acceptable to use a particular term, a particular word, when maybe in the past it wasn't acceptable. How do you come to the conclusion to say, okay, now this is a word? It wasn't before, it is now.
Well, almost everything is a word. I mean, the idea that the dictionary is in a position to decide what's a word and what isn't is just wrong. But the question is, at what point can you use a word? And the question is, in what context? And with whom? I think there are usages that I wouldn't countenance now. I just think are wrong or mistakes. Simplistic, for example. I keep seeing people talking about something as being refreshingly simplistic, and I think no, you don't understand what simplistic means. It just becomes a synonym for simple. Now, it could be that in 20 or 30 or 40 years' time, people will be using simplistic just in an ordinary way without raising even the eyebrows of old farts like me. But for the time being, I consider that an error. There are items like this that continue for a long time. People confuse militate and mitigate. That mitigates against a peaceful solution to the problem. And so people have been complaining about that one for, I don't know, 50, 60 years, and it's still out there. And although people use mitigate that way quite frequently, it still isn't acceptable, or at least it's not acceptable for writing in public context.
Let's take a call. We have Terry on the line from Kankakee. Hi, Terry.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is a response to having done something. At the end of your conversation, you're going to the moderator is going to say thank you very much for being here, and you're going to say back to him, thank you, instead of saying, you're welcome.
That's well, just, yeah, you know, a lot of people
binds my nerves up into little tiny bundles.
I hear that from a lot of people, notably my wife, so I'm very sensitive.
Oh, good. I think your wife is a very smart and intelligent woman.
But I'm not going to disagree with you, and she's certainly not going to disagree with you. But I think there's a reason why one sometimes doesn't want to say you're welcome, because to say you're welcome acknowledges that there is something to be thanked for. And you may want to imply to somebody, oh, don't thank me, it was nothing, I didn't go out of my way, by way of making the person feel less of a sense of gratitude, which is a polite sense to do, a polite thing to do. So in a way, there are times when saying you're welcome says you're absolutely right, I did a big thing for you, as opposed to saying it's nothing or thank you, which is to say, oh, it really wasn't anything, you don't have to thank me at all, which I can see is in certain contexts being the more polite thing to do.
Well, let's test this out. Terry, thank you for your call.
You're welcome.
Aha! Well done, sir.
I know.
All right. Go ahead, Jeff.
No. Please.
All right. You're listening to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is linguist Jeff Nunberg, frequent contributor to Fresh Air and the New York Times, among other publications. He teaches at the UC Berkeley School of Information and is emeritus chair of the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary. He's also the author of several books about language, including his latest, Ascent of the A Word. We're talking about words and word origins, and we welcome your questions and comments about common or even uncommon words or phrases in the English language, grammar pet peeves, cliches, basically anything you'd like to address about the words we use and how we use them. To call us, you just pick up the phone and call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We have an email from John who takes us back to politics a little bit and wants to hear your response to the notion of the universal substitution of grow for encourage, increase, expand. He says, it drives me up a wall. How long has this gone on? Seems like about 20 years, starting as a euphemism for raising taxes.
Yeah, it actually comes from business speech. I was hearing it maybe 30 years ago. We're going to grow revenues. We're going to try and grow the company. It means sort of to cause something to grow. And it's been around for a while. I'm not crazy about it, but I'm not sure why I object to it. So, and that's often the case. You have an intuition that you don't like something, and then you say, "Why don't I like that?" And you can't always figure it out. So I don't like it at all. It started in business. It's in political language now. A lot of language comes from business to politics these days, and that's just one of them.
We have an email from Elizabeth who says, I'm very curious to know if one were to be transported back in time to the Elizabethan era or Tudor, would we recognize the spoken language? Words, accent, syntax, would the language be decipherable as English?
Well, it's a question, again, of what you mean. If you were walking around in the market and trying to buy groceries, you might have some trouble just because the accent's different. It's not that different. You'd have a lot harder time in the age of Chaucer. Helga Kirkowitz, the great philologist, did a recording of Shakespeare, one of Shakespeare's sonnets, as he would have said it, and it was something like, "Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more fair, untemperate, rough winds do shake the darling buds." I mean, that sounds a little Irish, sounds a little Dorset. You probably could make sense of most of it, and it would take you a little while, but maybe no more time than it would to understanding what people are saying in, like, the Hackney neighborhood of London.
So it wouldn't necessarily be a question of the language itself, just the way it's spoken.
Well, the words are different. Yeah. I mean, we read Shakespeare. Kids read Shakespeare, and they need the glossary and the notes at the bottom of the page. Again, it depends on the context. It wouldn't be like, let me put it this way. If you had a choice of being dropped into Elizabethan London or modern Paris, in both cases without a knowledge of the language, go with London.
All right. Let's next go to Louise in Champaign. Good morning.
Hi. My pet peeve is envisage for envision, and I thought that was an American corruption for a while, but recently I found it in P.D. James, whose language I usually find exceptionally good. Has that change really taken place?
Well, it's out there. I don't know if it's. I mean, I don't know that envisage has been used that way. It's one of those pairs that it's like forcible and forceful, where you have the same root and two suffixes and two different meanings, and those always get confused. So, I'm not surprised at that one. What you say about thinking it's American, though?
Well, I had found it in American writing and speech, and not in British.
Yeah, there are a lot of phrases like that. There's a tendency on the part, not just of the English, which is understandable, but a part of Americans to assume if it's incorrect, it must be an Americanism.
No, I'm not.
The British complain about these Americanisms. They say, no, that's been part of British speech since the time of King Alfred. But,
yeah,
but sure. they want to have it this way.
All right. Thanks very much for the call, Louise. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is linguist Jeff Nunberg. We're taking your questions and comments about words, word origins, the phrases we use, and why and how we use them. To speak with Jeff Nunberg, call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Or you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll continue with our conversation in just a couple of minutes, but first, a reminder that WILL's fall fundraising campaign continues today. It's your opportunity to support the in-depth news and thoughtful analysis and conversation that you hear every day right here on WILL AM 580. We have a different phone number for you to do so, to make that contribution. 217-244-9455. That's 217-244-9455. Your contribution will help ensure the future of programs like Focus. Will also allow us to continue to provide news and information that's factual and offers context and clarity about the issues and ideas that affect us all. You make this important service available not just for you, but for everyone throughout East Central Illinois and Western Indiana and wherever else in the world you may be listening to us online. To tell us more about the importance of your contribution and where those dollars go, we are joined now by Les Schulte. Hi, Les.
Hi, Craig. You know, I'm very nervous being on with Jeff because I'm sure I'm going to say something really stupid. And I enjoy his segments on Fresh Air.
All right.
Very, very much.
Well, you know, it could be really stupid or stupider or stupidest, and apparently that's acceptable now. So.
Well, good. Okay. Yeah. Probably be the stupidest then. 217-244-9455 or go online to willpledge.org. I was just thinking as I was listening to Jeff this morning and how important a program like Focus is and the variety of guests that we are able to bring. So, for example, in the 3 days so far, this week, we've heard from Steve Inskeep, a national personality.
Journalist.
And journalist that you have opportunity to talk to right here locally. We've heard from Rodney Davis, candidate for Congress, yesterday. And now we have Jeff, another national personality, linguist of national here I am. I can't even think of the word, Jeff. Jeff, I need a word.
Hi.
217-244-9455. If you appreciate the fact that you have a program locally like this in your community, Focus is that program. Support this program with your pledge call. Whatever amount you can contribute, whatever amount you can pledge is greatly appreciated. You decide that, but make that call, make that pledge of support. Maybe pledge $90 in support of our 90th anniversary this year and get that 90th anniversary pride pack as your thank you gift.
Les, are you able to give us any sort of update, any numbers, anything you
yes,
can share with
actually,
us at this point?
Yes, actually, so far, another good morning, Craig. We've raised $6,547
Fantastic.
This morning from 25 pledges. Thank you very much. And why don't you join the Friends of WILL who are supporting this week. This is a very important week for WILL. It is your dollars that help make these programs possible. 217-244-9455.
Or again online at willpledge.org, and we thank you very, very much.
Support comes from the Klein Center for Democracy on the U of I campus with the 2012 Klein Symposium keynote address, Dealing with Debt and Deficits in a Dysfunctional Political Environment, by Dr. Norman Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute, Monday, October 22nd at 7:30 p.m. at the Alice Campbell Alumni Center Ballroom. Details at kleincenter.illinois.edu.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is linguist Jeff Nunberg. We're taking your questions and comments about words, word origins, the phrases we use, why and how we use them. And we welcome your phone call now at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll go next to Heather in Kankakee. Heather.
Hi. I have actually something that drives me crazy is when people use try and instead of try to. But the question that I have is whether route or route is the correct pronunciation of the word R-O-U-T-E?
All right.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I say route. I know people who say route. I can't imagine what it would be like to believe deeply that one of those is correct. I mean, I think it's a difference in dialect. People, I think, from the Midwest and South, I've heard saying route. So I don't have a strong preference on that. The great usage writer H.W. Fowler said, in pronunciation, the object should be to pronounce as your neighbors do and know better.
Hmm. We've had the debate whether there is one correct pronunciation of that in our home.
Yeah, no, there are a lot of that happens around a lot of dinner tables. But there are simply times when one pronunciation is that. You know, we at the American Heritage Dictionary, when we do the usage panels, we sometimes give this panel of esteemed writers and editors and scholars questions about pronunciation. And I recall a couple of years ago, this is after the Clarence Thomas Supreme Court hearings, we asked them about the word that's spelled H-A-R-R-A-S-S, I can't remember if it's one R or two, and half of them said Harris, and half of them said harass. And that wasn't the interesting thing. The interesting thing is that both sides thought they were in a minority. So one side would say, I say Harris, but I know this is a losing battle. And the other side said, I say harass, but I've just about given up on trying to win on this one. So even at the most distinguished levels of English usage, people just disagree about how to pronounce words. Banal.
There's default and default.
I beg your pardon?
Defense and defense, or default and default.
Right. And well, in those cases, it often depends on the context. You know, I think defense is what you're going to hear more on the football field, for example, or than perhaps in the Pentagon.
All right. Thanks very much for that phone call. We have some more emails coming in. Ted points out primetime broadcast television has become incredibly nasty, using every implication and double entendre available. What does this say about our society in 2012?
Well, I have a bunch of examples at the top, none of which are coming to mind. I've been noticing that, certainly, that people do play the limits. It says that we've come to believe that the restrictions on the use of certain kinds of language that we impose, basically just on primetime broadcast television, you can say them up on HBO, pay cable, you can say them often on free cable, that those restrictions serve a more symbolic purpose than a moral one. If it's okay to say the word, 50 notches up on the dial, why isn't it okay to say it here? And people will give you a reason, well, children might be listening and so on. I think those are basically symbolic restrictions, and that's why people feel free to play with them. I don't know that necessarily that means that it's a bad thing to have the restrictions. I think we do need symbolic restrictions on this word, just so we can remember that they're dirty words, so that they're available to us when the neighbor starts the leaf blower at 7 o'clock on a Sunday morning.
Bruce asks you to please campaign to teach students starting in kindergarten to limit their use of the word like to mean the opposite of dislike, or when they need a simile.
Oh, you mean I was like tired? Or
yes.
There are two uses that drive people crazy.
I think that's what he's talking about.
This is up there with literally as one of the three or four biggest bugbears. There's the use, I was like so tired I couldn't keep my eyes open. And then there's the use, so he was like, get out of here. It's a kind of what linguists call a quotative. They both have a use, those uses of like, and very few things emerge in language that aren't in some way useful. It's not just a filler. Sometimes it weakens the statement. You say, could I like borrow your sweater, which seems a little more polite or diffident than could I borrow your sweater. The other one, so he was like, get out of here, indicates that what's following isn't just a quotation, but a kind of performance or impersonation. So you say, so he was like, where you probably wouldn't say, so he said, ow. So each of them has a use. Each of them is appropriate in its context. I would discourage anybody from using them in, for example, a job interview.
Next up is David in Urbana. Hi, David.
Yes. I have a pair of words that I'd like to contribute, but I'd like to comment on root. I think it's one of those words where, in this case, I think it was probably back in the 16th century. The pronunciation started to shift, and then it froze, so that you have two equally acceptable pronunciations, which are largely dependent upon locality. Another class of words is roof, roof, hoof, hoof, and quite a few other similar words, where there are two equally correct pronunciations.
Yeah, there are a number of those. I don't know if the root-route distinction, it could have come from what you're describing as the great vowel shift, the big dance that English vowels did beginning in the 16th, 17th century. But there are lots of words like this, leisure, leisure. I keep running across, and people keep asking me, which is correct? And I don't know which is correct. It depends where you grew up and who you're going to school with.
Sometimes they are also be a key to class, but not always. The two words
that's certainly true, yes.
Drive me rather up a wall, figuratively, are persuasion and convince. I think originally convince was a state of mind. Convinced was a state of mind. Persuasion is the effort to change someone's position. And therefore, you'll hear something to the effect, the governor who had been trying everything, including twisting arms, sought to convince his opponents that he was right. Where persuade would be probably the correct word to use, it has a connotation which could be somewhat offensive, and usually TV and radio personalities don't want to offend the governor. Therefore, he sought to convince rather than to persuade.
Jeff, do you see a distinction
between
those two terms?
Yeah, I think that's nicely, nicely argued. There is a distinction. Some people make a big, insist on it. To my mind, it's one of those distinctions that is never going to become general. Most people, people don't use them quite interchangeably. I'm convinced that we're going to win, and I'm persuaded that we're going to win, have different implications. But there are two words that are used in kind of roughly similar ways, and most people do that. And there are a few people who insist on using them correctly, like the caller, and I guess like myself, who can go to bed at night saying to ourselves, well, I pride myself on making a distinction between persuade and convince. And the opportunity to say I pride myself about some point of usage is an important reason why these distinctions persist.
Let's next go to Rick in Robinson. Rick, good morning.
Good morning. I'm calling about the word moron, which Oxford English Dictionary dates to its first appearance in print as about 1920. I find that surprising, but it also leads to a bon mot that when Joseph Smith wrote the Book of Mormon, he presently named his chief angel the gold statue on the top of innumerable Mormon temples, Moroni, which leads to my estimation that he was a very precedent in this case, because the proper adverb, or adjective rather, after that is moronic religion.
Well,
yeah, if he did, and if it wasn't the gentleman's real name as opposed to Smith having made it up, let's not make theological presuppositions here. But you're absolutely right. Moron is an interesting word, along with other words of that type, like imbecile and so on. They're always introduced as clinical terms to dispel the stigma that attaches to that. I don't know, looking for a generic term for intelligence levels below a certain level. They're introduced and they become common, and then rapidly they acquire the stigma. So imbecile was originally a clinical term, moron was originally a clinical term, and there are others going up. Retarded now is a word about which people are having a lot of discussion, because it, again, was a clinical term and now is being used generally as a slur, and people are saying don't use retarded, certainly don't use retarded in that way. So this has been going on for a long, long time, and probably will be going on for a long, long time, because this is one of the the features of humanity that people find it most difficult to overcome their aversion to.
On the subject of religion, are there religious terms, words or phrases that maybe originally had religious connotations that in our everyday language today they don't, but they still survive with some other meaning?
Gee, yeah, there are, and now I'm trying to think what's coming. Well, religious is one. I mean, religious in the 16th century, people begin to use it to mean simply scrupulous. Is a religious attendance in school, his religious attendance at work. Some people have argued that that had to do with using the model of religion to confer legitimacy on the newly emerging practices of merchant capitalism. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know. But there's a lot of language that certainly comes from the church and from religion that that then just pervades our everyday life. And I wish I could come up with an example, and I'm drawing a blank.
All right. Well, we'll go next to Tim in Charleston. Hi, Tim.
Hi. A phrase that just drives me up a wall is exact same. It's the exact same thing. I hear that so often, it just makes me want to cry. A phrase I just enjoy using is lousy with. The airwaves are lousy with political ads right now.
Right. Not on public media, but go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think it's interesting. The exact same, it's another one of those very common intensifiers that's... there are certain intensifiers that are restricted to one word. You know, the only thing you can modify with blithering is idiot. Exactly.
The only thing you can warn is perjury, too.
But the words you enjoy saying, I think that's great. We spend too much time talking about words we hate and not at all enough time talking about the words we like. I'm just doing a Fresh Air piece that will air later in the week about Britishisms in American speech. And I was saying, well, there's some that are just pretentious and affected, but there's some I love. For example, dab hand, to mean an expert. And I was saying to my wife the other day, boy, you're a real dab hand at Googling. And every time I say it, I take a little pleasure in saying it. So we should think more about the words we enjoy.
The words we like. And this is perhaps not quite in your area, but it's something I see when I'm reading student papers. When they are referring to something from a decade, the 1990s, the 1970s, the use of the apostrophe or not. To me, it's, you know, if you're referring to something coming out of those decades, it's no apostrophe. It's just you're pluralizing those years. But
I go both ways on it, and I think the reason I go both ways on it is the editors I work with go both ways on it.
Exactly.
The New York Times does one thing, and NPR does another, and I can't remember which is which. So it's another one of these practices of punctuation about which there's a lot of variation. I wrote a book on punctuation once, and the one thing that struck me was that, you know, nobody really gets it. me included. I mean,
you were talking about the fact that we tend to fixate on words we don't like and not so much on the words we like. I find the words that I tend to like are onomatopoetic, that if they sound like what they mean, I have this sort of endearing feeling about them. I was thinking of the word mellifluous. You almost can't say mellifluous without saying it in a mellifluous way.
It's certainly true, the mel, the M, and the L. And so,
yeah.
What's interesting also is words whose sound seems to run very counter to their meaning. I think, you know, if we didn't know what it meant, wouldn't melanoma be one of the most beautiful words?
Oh, that's
in
an interesting
English
point.
Language? Or diarrhea, for example. Those are very lovely words and unfortunately tacked to less than pleasant meanings.
Well, I'm not sure about that last, but okay. Next up is Janet in Champaign. Hi, Janet.
Hi. I have a pet peeve that I think I've totally lost the battle on it, but I hate using the people who use, well, I don't hate people. I hate the use of the dove as the past and past participle of dive. I think, and I'm sure that I learned growing up 1,000 years ago, that it was dive, dived, dived. And what happened?
Well, it's a very interesting case to linguists, probably to no one else, but the tendency in the history of English has been for what we call strong verbs to become weak. Strong verbs are, you know, the irregular verbs like write, wrote, and seesaw, and so on. And the tendency has been for those to become the ordinary verbs to which we add ed. Every once in a while, a weak verb will become a strong verb. And dive, dove is one of those. I'm not sure exactly when that happens, but it's a very the snook, which we talked about in a moment ago, is another one. They're a fascinating case because they seem to be running against the course of history, so to speak. I don't have more to say about that.
All right, let's next go to Shelley in Champaign. Hi, Shelley.
Hi. I was wondering. I've heard older radio clips, like from the 40s, maybe even the 30s, and it sounds, I'm not sure if it's in a different accent or if it's a different type of diction they're using, but it sounds different from radio hosts from today. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, that's a wonderful point. The if you listen, I play to my students in a history of communications class, history of information class I teach, I play them of audios of people like the H.B. Kaltenborn, whose mellifluous tones were heard over the radio throughout the 30s and 40s, and he had a stagey kind of delivery that would be absurd even in a newscaster today. If you listen to Charles Coughlin, the radio priest, the right wing radio broadcaster of the 30s, again, his delivery is oratorical and absurd by the standards of what we would hear from, say, Rush Limbaugh today, somebody in a roughly similar position. So. You're right. Broadcasting English has become much more informal, much more colloquial. It's much more like having a conversation with the audience. And the fact that often they are actual conversations, like the one the three of us are having now, may have something to do with that.
Well, I wonder if we could also put newsreels of the 1940s in that same context. You know, those voices doing the news on the march kind of thing, where it's really highly stylized. You know.
Right. No, that's absolutely right. And you look up these people. I mean, you find out who these people were, and you think this must be somebody who, you know, was born in the UK and moved to Boston when he was 11, and it turns out he grew up in you know, Champaign, Urbana. So this was very much a, I don't want to say an affectation, but it was a style that was considered necessary to give the news its authority.
We have had a number of emails come in, a number of comments online. I was wondering if we could try rolling through several of these. I'll just mention them, and if you have a comment, dive in and let me know if you have any thoughts about it. Heather wants to know about regardless versus irregardless.
Oh, yeah, irregardless is that most monstrous of non-words, Life magazine called it when it first appeared in Webster's Third International Dictionary in 1961. It was to that era as, I don't know, incentivize or impact or literally is to ours. So it's the classic non-word. Now, of course, it is a word if people use it, but again, it's one that you're advised to avoid in submitting letters to the editor or in job interviews.
Aggressiveness versus aggression and how they are maybe misused. In particular, this comment says, my husband generally hears the word when sportscasters are talking about a player. He thinks it should be aggression, not aggressiveness.
Well, I think, and I haven't looked at this, I think aggressiveness implies a kind of disposition to be aggressive, and aggression refers to the act itself. So his aggression was unforgivable. His aggressiveness is admirable, perhaps. But I haven't thought about that one.
Jan shares her disdain for mispronounced words such as nuclear versus nuclear.
Yeah, I had a book a couple of years ago, a collection of radio pieces that I called Going Nuclear, because I wanted to talk about that word. Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air, had to ID me all the time by saying, you know, his most recent book is Going Nuclear. And she invariably got letters, Terry Gross, you of all people.
So. Kelly writes, the phrase my bad comes to mind, especially when an adult uses it, grr.
Oh, come on. That's right. I like it. It's colorful. The British make a fuss about it, which is always, they get indignant about it, which is always a reason for me to think there's something good about it. I like it. It's colorful. It's evocative. It's five letters and two syllables long. What's not to like?
Jay would like to know, when did gift become a verb?
Oh, it's one of the, I think the 50s and 60s you start to see it. Gift her with a silver ring or something like that. These noun to verb shifts, are, on the one hand, they're mother's milk to English. Something like 20% of the verbs in English began their lives as nouns, and lots of them we don't mind at all. A fax or monogram or telegraph, I mean, all of those verbs, nouns easily become verbs. And then a few of them, like gift, like author, like premier, somehow stick in people's craws. I think usually for a good reason. I think people smell that there's something pretentious about them. but it's often hard to say why.
Speaking of smell, Mike would like to know where PU comes from. Does it mean personal umbrage?
No, it surely doesn't. But I think it's just, and I'm guessing here, don't hold me to this. I think it's probably a kind of joke spelling of pew, you know, of the noise people make when they conventionally when they smell something bad.
Ted asks, he's always found the term "get the gist of something" a strange term. I was just curious where that origin comes from.
It's an old expression. I haven't looked at the exact date, but it goes back a long, long time. It's cognate, which is to say related to the German Geist or spirit. And goes back to Germanic, I mean, Old English. So I don't know I'm not sure if it was pronounced at what point it just had acquired that meaning, but it goes back a long, long time.
And Sasha asks, isn't language essentially a culturally symbolic wrapping paper for deeper understandings?
Yeah, it's of course it is. The question of whether it's wrapping paper or the product itself, the gift itself, is one that linguists and other people have pondered on. One notices, Eliot writes, one notices if one will trust one's eyes, the shadow cast by language upon truth. And others would say, no, the language is the truth. So it's the deepest question one can ask about language, and well put.
I think we have time maybe for one more call, and this might be a good one on which to wrap up. Marlene is in Urbana. Marlene, welcome to the show. What's your comment or question?
Yes, hello. I want to share something with you that has plagued me my whole life because my father would drill it into me constantly, even when I was an adult. And that was his pet peeve, which was when people say, I'm done. And he said, done's for turkeys. And then I would say, well, I'm finished. And he said, no, you're not finished either. You have finished. When did I'm done start coming into the language?
You know, I think it goes back a long, long time, and I think people like your father have been making a fuss about it for a long, long time, which isn't to say they're wrong, but if everybody did, in fact, start to say, I have finished, or which is the way you say it in a lot of European languages, your dad would have had nothing to complain about it.
Oh, I know. It's been constant. But every time I say it, I do think of turkeys.
Right.
Thanks very much for the call.
He did his job, your dad.
Well, Jeff, you're done. Finished.
Well, thanks very much. I have finished.
Jeff Dunberg comments on language for NPR's Fresh Air. He's a professor at the UC Berkeley School of Information and emeritus chair of the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary and the author of several books about language. His latest is Ascent of the A Word. Jeff Dunberg, thank you very much for joining us on Focus today.
Thanks. Anytime.
You got in the you're welcome. All right. Programs like Focus are only possible because of individuals like you who become annual contributors to WILL. We provide these conversations and the in-depth news and information, the contextual analysis about the issues and ideas affecting our lives, but annual donors provide the funds that make it all possible. We simply couldn't do this without your friends and neighbors stepping up and making contributions each year. Join the Friends of WILL. Make a gift right now, a contribution at 217-244-9455. That's 244-WILL, or make a gift online at WILLwillpledge.org. Here once again is Les Schulte. Les, how are things going?
Things are going great, Craig. So far, we've raised $37,388 since we started the pledge drive on Monday. That's a terrific start. We wanted to hear from at least 100 new friends. We've heard from 80 new friends so far.
Fantastic.
During this drive. That's great. So we need to keep the momentum going. That's why if you appreciate this program, if you appreciate the fact that Focus is on the air, that there are guests like Jeff Nunberg, so that you can talk to them directly with your question, call this number and make that pledge, because it's your dollars that help keep this show going year after year, day after day, week after week. The number is 217-244-9455. Or pledge online at willpledge.org, and think about making that $90 a year pledge.
Les, we have a couple of minutes here. I thought it might be appropriate to talk a little bit about how it is we do fund this station, how it is we pay for the programs you hear. It's really somewhat I'm now talking with a linguist.
I know,
to mind, I realize, I shouldn't say somewhat unique. That's wrong.
Dangerous territory.
But it is unusual within the public media system to do this, but we forward fund by a year. We spend this entire year, between now and June 30th, we are raising all of the dollars necessary to pay for next year's programs.
That's right, Craig. And it is. Most stations don't do that. We are one of few that do that around the country. We do get money from the federal government. That's kind of the base that we have. That's important, too. We get money from the state. We get money from the university. But 40% of the money comes from you, the listeners. And the way we do it is we collect that money. We raise that money 1 year so that we know when we go into the following year how much money we have to spend on programs, on services, on equipment to make sure that we can keep the best programs available coming to you. And that's why this fund drive right now is important. If you appreciate that fact, call this number, 217-244-9455, or go online to willpledge.org. Make your contribution in any amount that fits into your budget. Again, you decide that. We don't put it out. Say Fresh Air is going to cost you 10 bucks a day if you want to listen or anything like that. You decide how valuable these services are to you, and then make that call.
217-244-9455 or online at willpledge.org. Thanks very much. On tomorrow's show, a number of eyebrows were raised by the decision last week to give this year's Nobel Peace Prize to the European Union. We will learn more about what was behind that decision and discuss the history, complexity, and potentially challenging future of the EU, including the fate of the euro as a common currency and the viability of economically struggling nations like Greece. We'll talk with Dr. Stefanos Katsikas, Director of Modern Greek Studies at the University of Illinois. We also hope to have João Vale de Almeida, the European Union Ambassador to the United States, join us sometime during the hour. That's on tomorrow's program. Today's show is produced by Travis Stanzel. Kyle Mabry is our technical director. He handled your calls today. I'm Craig Cohen.